Welcome to the Unrest Podcast. I'm Madeline Green.
I'm Caitlin Stansel.
And I'm Carter Coyle.
So I'm taking us to Scotland today.
Yay!
To the site of body snatchers, some violent ghosts, and even a loyal dog.
Ooh! Oh! She's itching on cue. Oh.
I thought she was running to you. So this story talks about Greyfriars Kirkyard, and it's claimed to be one of the world's most haunted graveyards.
Ooh.
And what I've gathered is that kirkyard is another word for cemetery. So,
Oh, that helps.
And the cemetery dates back to the 1560s, so it has a ton of history. And all of that history has really led to some strange and downright scary paranormal experiences. So I'm going to start by telling you about one of the main ghosts that is believed to be haunting this area, and his name is George Mackenzie. He's said to be one of the most aggressive ghosts and the most active. So while alive, he was a ruthless prosecutor and a merciless judge who presided over the trials of the Presbyterian Covenanters in the 1670s. And hopefully I said Covenanters right.
Never even heard of that.
Yeah, I hadn't either, but it's actually a really interesting story. So they wanted permission from the king to practice their religion freely, but Bloody Mackenzie, as he was known, tried to crush this rebellion by imprisoning 1,200 of these Covenanters in a field next to the graveyard in what is considered to be one of the world's first concentration camps, if that gives you any kind of idea of what this was like for these people. So the prisoners spent about 4 months awaiting trial. And while they were there, they were held outside. They had no shelter and very little food. And then it gets worse for this group of people because of the 269 that lived, they were sold as slaves to the West Indies as their punishment. And in their travels there, the ship they were on sank and 200 more of them died.
Jeez.
And so just really,
their only crime was they wanted to have free religion.
Yes, that was their crime.
Wow.
So really, there's like a lot of unrest and trauma connected to this site. But those paranormal attacks that I was talking about, those didn't really start until 1999. And that was when it was rumored a homeless man broke into the Mackenzie's vault and unleashed his evil force.
Uh-oh.
So when the man tried to break into the casket as well, apparently he stepped backwards and he also fell into this old pit, the plague victims that had been there for centuries as well.
There were just still pits of dead plague people lying around?
I think they were very decomposed at this point and like ashy, like crusty, not like fresh.
Crusty? Like crusty, not slimy.
Yeah, like dry.
As long as they're crusty and not slimy.
Gonna have to fall into a bunch of plague bodies.
But apparently the freeing of the Mackenzie's ghost was actually predicted by famed Scottish poet Robert Louis Stevenson in one of his books in 1879. So here's what he wrote. He said, "When a man's soul is certainly in hell, his body will scarce lie quiet in a tomb, however costly." So how has Bloody Mackenzie helped the Greyfriars Kirkyard, earn its reputation as the most haunted cemetery in the world? Here's how. Visitors have left that graveyard with bruises, scratches, bite marks, burns.
Oh, no thank you.
Some have even passed out and gotten sick. And then there have been two failed attempts at exorcism in Greyfriars. Strangely as well, one of those exorcists died about a week later from a heart attack.
Oh, that's messed up.
And it's reported that there had been at least 450 documented attacks and 140 people have collapsed.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So apparently these attacks have really escalated to the point where the city where this graveyard is located, which is Edinburgh, they closed off the Covenanters' prison, which is that concentration camp where all those people were held, from the public. And the city only allows controlled visits, which have basically become tours for tourists. But here's what they say. If you want to take a tour, beware. They warn, quote, the McKenzie poltergeist can cause genuine physical and mental distress. Join the tour at your own risk.
He's already causing me mental distress right this second.
We're not even there.
Try not to think about it.
But if you ever went to Scotland, now we would have to do it. I mean.
Yeah, obviously.
I'd have to bring my anxiety meds. I'd be popping them like Tic Tacs.
Well, okay.
You're not possessed, just for fun. Madeline. You're fine.
Don't worry. I'm going to end this story with a little bit of a livelier note. But first, I have to tell you about this. So there are some other interesting things about this graveyard. Its features include enclosed burial layers that either have solid stone walls or iron railings. And this was done for a purpose because they were trying to deter grave robbing there. Mm. And then if you do go, you might notice two more unusual things. They're kind of these two low cages that are built out of iron, and they cover the length of two graves. And they were called mort safes. And these were least protected bodies for just long enough that they could deter the attentions of early 19th century resurrection men.
Mm. Okay, you just said a bunch of stuff I don't know about.
So resurrection men are those body snatchers that I mentioned earlier. And in the early 1800s, the University of Edinburgh's prestigious medical studies program, they needed cadavers for those students to study. And this sparked this big underground trade in corpses that were stolen by body snatchers or those resurrection men, and they were sold to local students. And this was happening so often that these things called mort safes had to be invented to keep bodies safe until they were past the point of decomposition that these students couldn't use them anymore. And I'm going to show you a photo of them because they're kind of interesting. So these are what the mort safes look like.
Ooh.
Wow, that is not appealing.
No, but I mean,
bodies would be in there?
Under the ground. So these were really to just cover up where they were buried. And the iron work goes deep into the ground so that people couldn't dig up the graves.
Or like animals, I guess.
I was wondering. I was like,
people, animals like, too.
Go around it, but okay, it's down deep.
Yeah. So they're definitely creepy looking. And then here's some other pictures. This is the Martyrs Monument.
Oh, that's pretty.
For some other people that died there. This was a sketching. So it's really like beautiful and ornate, all of the burial sites there. This is within the Covenanters prison where all those people died. And then these are kind of like, you know, more traditional headstones that you would see today. But then look at these.
Holy cow. Wow.
They're kind of like almost a wall. They're so close together there.
When we were in Ireland, the whole time people were saying, oh, are you going to Scotland too? It was like, yeah, Ireland's great, but you gotta go to Scotland. So I hope to go someday.
Me too.
Yeah. And so this is where George Mackenzie is buried. He has this domed mausoleum here. And that was the one that was apparently broken into by the homeless man. So some really neat photos. So to wrap this story up on a bit of a lighter note, the graveyard is also associated with Grey Friars Bobby. And this was the loyal dog of a shepherd there. And apparently he missed his owner so much that he slept at his grave 14 years.
What?
And his owner was buried in the Grey Friars Kirkland. So after the dog passed away, they made a little memorial to him. And he has this little statue.
Aww.
So cute. He's like a little terrier.
How cute is that?
That's so sweet.
It doesn't necessarily say that this dog haunts the cemetery, but I thought it was just a cute little feature of it to make up for all the really terrible stuff that has happened there.
Yeah.
And that is the most haunted graveyard in the world.
So since we are talking about graveyards for today's haunted history, we're going to take a look into kind of the history of burials and gravestones and that kind of thing. Even though we don't really have any evidence of the first graves or burials, we do have evidence of the acts of respecting the dead and kind of giving them a burial, which has gone on literally since we have inhabited this earth. They have evidence of, you know, just different things that people have done to respect the dead. Gravestones or grave markers, as they're commonly known as, are believed to kind of date back as far as 3000 BC to Celtic cultures.
Wow.
So for a long time, they've had this kind of gravestone. Now, they've looked definitely different than what we see today. They were more like monuments, kind of like the one that you showed us, the mausoleum type one, but they were marked for entire families. So instead of having like single stones to mark people's burials, they had these huge monuments where they would put almost all of the family members in there together. And then cemeteries were kind of non-existent back then. They almost put all these monuments at their homes, just making it easier for everyone to be buried together and easier for people to visit and pay their respects. So it was very likely that if you went to someone's home, somewhere on the property, you would find one of these huge monuments. When they began putting these markers on graves, they were made of stone or wood. Eventually, they began to also put these big pieces of stone and wood on top of the grave, and it was about the size of a body instead of just like the little sticker stones, because they were having a lot of issues with bodies rising from the ground. So they felt like if they put, you know, a big rock on top of the body, that it would kind of keep it underground.
Digging deep enough.
Yeah, that's what I think. I think a lot of the issue, when you think about back then, maybe they didn't put them in caskets, obviously, or just some issues of having these bodies rise from the ground. And I think that's what made people think of people coming back from the dead a lot of the times too, because they would rise up out of the ground, which is kind of spooky.
Or maybe they would find them the next day after an animal had been like digging or something.
Right. And so after they moved into making these headstones, they also did a thing called a footstone along with the headstones. And that kind of showed you how long the grave was. And so you had the headstone, obviously, at the head, and then you had these little smaller things called footstones at the feet. They would put just basic things on them, like initials to mark that it went with that headstone. Nowadays, you don't really see that as much anymore. And you also see sometimes, like you showed us, the mausoleum, which I think is kind of like an approach to what those huge monuments were back then. The materials that were used also changed quite a bit. I read an article that said in North America from 1861 until around 1873, wooden headstones were used to mark the graves of Civil War soldiers, because it was the easiest thing to use because most everything else was being used as resources for the war. Now, obviously, wood does not stand the test of time, so they moved on to other things like marble. They used a bunch of marble headstones, but then if you didn't know, that marble is actually a really soft material. And so the longer time went by, they noticed that that marble also kind of deteriorated. Anything that was written on the stone, you can't read anymore. And so they decided they needed to find a different type of material to make headstones out of. Most common one would be granite. It's really popular for headstones. The variety of colors, there's different textures. They're very durable, and it kind of makes granite like ideal choice. And it's definitely not as soft as marble. So anything that was inscribed on it has pretty much stayed pretty clear, even though you couldn't do it as intricate as you could in marble for some reason. And then also, like, another reason that some of these headstones didn't make it was because of the acid that's in the rain. So also, headstones kind of hold an important part in religious ceremonies and traditions. Burial has been a part of the Christian, Jewish, and Muslim traditions surrounding death for as long as religions have been documented, which it sounds terrible, but when religions realized that they could make money off of this is when they really started getting involved in the burials. Kind of sad.
Maybe that's why churches have graveyards now.
Yeah. I found a pretty neat website that kind of goes through all of these symbols and what they might mean to each person that's buried there. A lot of it said if it's an angel, a lot of times that kind of depicts a child that might be buried there.
There's one, anchors. If you see anchors on any gravestones, it's early Christians used anchors that were disguised as crosses as a marker to guide the way to a secret meeting place. I thought that was really crazy.
Whoa, and then it shows, that's weird.
Yeah, it shows a picture of it, and it's true. It looks like a cross anchor.
That's cool.
But then it said it also could represent a life of a sailor if you see an anchor on a gravestone. A broken column signifies a life that was cut short. And so a long time ago, me and Caitlin did a story on graveyard typography. And that is also a very important thing when it comes to gravestones.
We actually went to a place that engraves headstones, and
what a cool story.
Showed us how the process goes, and they like sandblast it. It's really neat.
Also, the kind of the last thing that I found out was about the inscriptions that are found on gravestones. The information on headstones generally includes the name of the deceased, the date of birth, the death. And this information is put on all gravestones because it makes it very useful for the genealogists or local historians to find certain people that lived around those areas and be able to, you know, hook them up with their families and whatnot if it gets lost somehow. There are also some national guidelines that encourage the use of tasteful wording on your tombstones. And the placements of inscriptions are generally placed forward facing. Sometimes you'll see stuff on the reverse side or around the edges of a stone. Some families request that an inscription be on the portion of the memorial that is underground. I thought that was pretty interesting.
What? Like I never thought of that. I bet there's some good stuff.
Right? And then today, obviously, we see a bunch of gravestones with pictures on them.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. You see that more.
I saw one not too long ago that had like the the picture of like this man's truck.
Aww.
On his gravestone. But yeah, pretty funny. And then this, I found this and it said, marker inscriptions have also been used for political purposes as well. And there was a grave marker installed in January of 2008 at Cave Hill Cemetery in Kentucky by Matthew Prescott, who was an employee of PETA. The grave marker is located near the grave of KFC founder Harlan Sanders and bears the acrostic message that KFC tortures birds.
Oh my gosh.
The group placed the grave marker to promote its idea that KFC is cruel to the chickens.
Of course they did.
So that made me kind of look into some other fun tombstones. And some of them are kind of sad. Some of them are fun. I found one from a Vietnam veteran, and it said, when I was in the military, they gave me a medal for killing two men and a discharge for loving one.
Oh, that's so sad.
Right? Then this one was pretty funny. So, you know how you have the gravestone and then you have the piece of marble like flat like this and the gravestone is on top of it. So, if you're standing looking down at it, it says, if you can read this, you're standing on my boobs.
I love that one.
My favorite one, which is something I would definitely have, is the one that says, I told you I was sick. There's one that says, I was hoping for a pyramid.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
This one says, raised four beautiful daughters with only one bathroom, and still there was love. Here lies an atheist, all dressed up and no place to go.
Oh, that's good.
I wonder if they chose that or their family. You talked about pictures. My grandparents actually, their headstone has their photo on it.
Aww. This one's pretty funny. It's a recipe and it says Kay's fudge. two squares of chocolate, 2 tablespoons of butter, melt on low heat, stir in 1 cup of milk, bring to boil, 3 cups of sugar, 1 tablespoon vanilla, pinch of salt, cook to softball stage, pour on marble slab, cool, beat, eat. Wherever she goes, there's laughter.
Wow, that's a good one.
Oh, this is for you, Carter. Susan Melody Blanchard, destined to be a woman with too many cats.
Love it. Well, today's real life haunt comes from Derek Shoemaker. So Derek is someone who we met online. Madeline found him actually, and he has a very interesting goal. He says he's trying to investigate as many haunted places as he can to see what they find versus what you see on TV. And they're focusing on these 93 haunted locations on New York's haunted history trail. So they've been to mansions and asylums and jailhouses and have had some great paranormal experiences and evidence. Here's what he has to say. So I am here today with Derek Shoemaker, who has a really cool job, or I don't know if you consider it a hobby, Derek, or a real job, but you guys spend a lot of time investigating haunted places all over New York with your group Paranormal of Watertown. Tell us a little bit about what y'all do.
Pretty much like you said, we just go to the most haunted places we can find in New York. It's pretty much a hobby at this point, but it's something that we would like to grow if we could. Pretty much there's a website called New York Haunted History Trail, I believe. And they have 93 sites on there that are supposed to be the most haunted locations in New York. So our ultimate goal is to investigate every single one of those sites and see for ourselves, you know, if we can collect evidence of the paranormal. And it's not just limited to New York either. Well, if it's, you know, a notoriously haunted location, we'll go there. Like, it's, if we have the times and the means to, then we want to try to investigate wherever we can, honestly. So
I saw you said 93 places. How many have you been to? And what kind of equipment do you bring to these locations to investigate?
I believe we've been to 12 of them as of right now. We formed at the end of 2018, myself and my brother-in-law are the co-founders. Pretty much what happened was, I think the way most people get into paranormal is they experience something themselves and then they, you know, piques that curiosity. So we actually moved into the house I bought, me and my, fiance did. And it was 2 days after we moved into the house, her father died. So then she felt his presence. So, yeah, so she felt his presence. And my brother-in-law was like, well, I have ghost hunting equipment from when I was into it, like, years ago. So let's, you know, see if we can find something. And lo and behold, there's something else in my house that's kind of, like, lingering. Not, like, a evil spirit or anything like that, but just we call him, like, a grumpy old man, kind of. And we've actually captured EVPs of him laughing, of him, you know, just – telling us to, why'd you have to leave? Why'd you leave the room? Stuff like that. So that's what kind of piqued our interest. And then, so we're like, well, what locations can we do? You know, he has equipment. He has like infrared cameras, full spectrum cameras that take digital pictures on a different spectrum that we can see with our naked eye, stuff like that. And over the past couple of years, we've been accumulating more equipment, trigger objects such as like a little teddy bear that lights up if the electromagnetic field gets stronger around it.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so we try to like get all these gadgets and stuff, but at the same time we try to keep it simple as well. And digital recorders is probably the most basic thing we can use because they record at a sound that our human ear can't hear. So if you pick up a voice, you know no one's in the room with you. And that's something that, you know, we like to focus on because it's very hard to debunk that as being something else. Like with images and video and cameras, people could say, well, that's just a shadow. That's just a light anomaly. That's dust. That's, you know, stuff like that. So,
but, y'all, and then when you go back and review all this, I imagine sometimes you might find or hear things that even in the moment you didn't hear.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, all the time. So pretty much, the way that our method goes, we'll go and do an investigation. Typically, we try to rent out the whole location so it's private. There's no, it's not like a public hunt where there's other investigators for like noise contamination and stuff like that. And we'll do our investigation. And then once we start reviewing it, it takes a solid 2 to 3 weeks even. And we don't even go through all the material we have because we have multiple people. We have anywhere from like on average 6 to 10 people that go on this investigation. We split up into groups of 3 or 2 to minimize the talking and like the shuffling around that people may do.
Right.
And as we're reviewing video, we're like, oh, we never heard that. So then what we try to do is we try to have a stationary camera filming everyone in the room. I personally wear a body cam, so that way if I say something under my breath or, you know, I pan around and it shows somebody talking, we can say, oh, okay, that wasn't a whisper. That was so-and-so talking. So we try to debunk everything first.
But you're kind of trying to prove it, debunk it yourselves, you know, and find any reasonable explanation before immediately hopping to this is paranormal.
Yeah, and I think that's another ultimate goal of our group, because you see all the paranormal shows on TV and stuff like that where you wonder how legitimate it is, how much of it is fabricated for ratings and stuff like that. So we make 100% honest effort not to put anything in our videos that we know isn't paranormal, or we know it was something else. So I would say about, you know, when we go through the initial audio on our recorders, we probably think, you know, maybe 10 things may be paranormal, and we'll whittle it down to maybe two or three that we really can't explain. And that's what ultimately makes it into the videos.
So just to remind everyone, this, we're talking about Paranormal of Watertown, and you'll have a very active YouTube page where you post a lot of these videos. And one of your more recent ones, Gravestone Manor, y'all called it one of the most active places that you've been to, phantom footsteps captured. Can you tell us a little bit about Gravestone Manor, or share your favorite example of activity that you've come across?
Yeah, so there's a couple. It's Gravestone Manor in Western New York. That was very active. I think the consensus of the group is that it was one of the most active places we've ever been to. There was phantom footsteps. We were in a room with the door closed. And the owner, I actually said, you'll hear footsteps all the time, like of a man like wearing like heavy horse boots or whatever he was wearing, because it used to be like a horse racing track.
Oh, and, wow. Okay, interesting.
Yeah, so we actually captured it, and we heard the footsteps live. And then our digital recorders captured it. So we're like, you hear that? So we're like, yeah. So we actually had a trail cam in the hallway to capture, you know, anything moving up and down the hallway. And what's funny is that we had every probably 20 seconds or so, the camera would go off recording something if a cat walked by or dust or any movement whatsoever. But the whole 28 minutes we were in that room, the camera didn't go off once, even with the footsteps. So it's almost like something manipulated the camera so that way it wouldn't be captured.
Wow.
We had a doll thrown at an investigator in one of the children's rooms.
Oh, no way.
And a lot of this stuff happens as soon as we turn off the camera or you turn away. So, but luckily Brad was recording and you can hear the doll getting thrown off the ladder, and then he pans over real quick. And Maria is sitting there like with a doll in her lap. She's like, oh, that just got thrown at me. So,
oh my gosh. And in the moment, I mean, are y'all ever scared or feel like it could be threatening?
Yeah, I mean, we get scared when it's something that's unexpected, you know, like, because a lot of times in the video, you'll see like the grayish view, and that's us seeing through night vision. So what you guys are seeing makes it look a lot more illuminated than what it is. We're just walking down like a dark hallway with like looking through LED or LCD screens. My fiance got really like shooken up when we went to Hillview Manor in Pennsylvania. They're up on the third floor using a spirit box, which pretty much the spirit box will cycle through radio stations at a very fast rate, where it's almost impossible for like a word or a phrase to come out.
Oh.
And the general idea is that a spirit can manipulate those radio frequencies and communicate through it. And this video is actually on the YouTube channel as well, where Jessica, one of our members, asked, do you want us to leave or do you want us to stay? And it's maybe 2 or 3 seconds, a very deep male voice comes through and says, you're staying. Like, and she just booked it. She was on the third floor.
Oh my gosh.
If you watch the video, it is absolutely nuts. It's actually on, if you go on our YouTube page on the Paranormal Watertown short little recap video, I think it's like a 3-minute preview.
Okay.
That clip is in there. That was one very active one. And actually the last one we just did, Wildwood Sanitarium, was very active. And I think part of that may be because we come in there with a lot of energy. We come in there with a lot of like research. We research the locations for about 2 weeks, 3 weeks prior. So a lot of these locations, when they were active, they were asylums or nursing homes or keep homes where there's a lot of people hustling and bustling in there. So I think if we replicate that energy they feed off that.
It almost comes back to life.
Yeah. And I think one of our personal favorites is the real Conjuring house that we went to. This is in Harrisville, Rhode Island. It's what spawned the movie The Conjuring based on true events for the Perrin family.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yep. And that's probably one of the most iconic haunted houses in America. It's from the I want to say like late 1600s, maybe early 1700s. I'm not sure exactly the date of the building, but it's colonial pre-Revolutionary War. And that was a very active location too. That was being an iconic haunted house that just recently opened up for paranormal investigators. It was an awesome experience to visit there. So
one of the things we love on the Unrest podcast is that we all take turns researching the stories and then giving some historical context. And honestly, we've learned a lot about the history of our country and other countries. And it's really very cool to investigate or research the history. And it sounds like that you said y'all do that for weeks before you go visit a location. And it seems like it would open your mind a lot when you go into a place to know this was used as a sanatorium for tuberculosis, or this was a children's orphanage, and this is what it was like here. It seems like that would just expand your mind of what kind of activity you might expect.
Yeah, I mean, it goes kind of both ways. Some investigators and some teams go in there blind, where they don't want to know anything. They want to let the evidence speak for themselves, so to speak. But I think we feel collectively as a group that the more you know about the location, the more you can connect with the spirit. And, you know, all of us, for the most part, believe that, you know, all the spirits here were once human. They still have an emotional connection. They're still here in this realm for whatever reason. And the more we know about the location, the more we can try to connect on their level, saying, hey, I know this is what happened to you. I know this is sad. For like the Virgin house that we went to, myself and Brad, we started asking questions about, because there was a story of a young woman who hung herself from the barn because she had like an illegitimate child with like the banker of the town or something. So we started asking questions like, you know, we know that pain, you know, we're fathers ourselves. We can't fathom what you went through. Can you tell us anything that you want to, you know, any message that you want to say to anybody? And then a lot of times we'll get responses just from, you know, talking to them like they're still here. So,
and that personal connection, the empathy.
Yeah, and we have several members in our group too. Like my cousin Christy, Jessica, who goes on the hunts with us, Maria, they're more like empaths and they're more sensitive, where they pick up feelings a lot more than some of the other team members, where they'll walk in a room and they're like, oh, this room's heavy, this room's sad. I don't want to say they're so much psychic, but they're more in tune with like the energy going, where I think we have a good mix with our group, because some of them like use their senses as instruments, and others of us use like actual scientific equipment to try to document it. So there's a healthy mix of, you know, using human intuition and using equipment. So.
Well, thank you very much for giving us insight and kind of a snapshot of what it's like to be a paranormal investigator. What a really cool thing that y'all get to do. And I hope that we can talk to you again, you know, maybe in the future when you have some neat stuff happen or you have some more videos you want to promote. We'd love to talk to you again and hear more about your investigations.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's definitely a fun hobby to do. You know, anyone can really go out and do it. It's just, you know, putting the effort in, finding the locations, and just, you know, just having fun with it. I think that's the primary reason why we do it, to have fun and to, you know, learn more about what we don't understand.
And you have to have a lot of bravery and courage too, to stay overnight in some of these places.
Yeah, it's a blast.
Well, thank you, Derek Shoemaker with Paranormal of Watertown. Everyone, please check out their YouTube channel. They've got some awesome videos. And as he was saying, they really vet them and share the most unexplainable things that happen to them as they investigate different paranormal places all over New York and in the Northeast. So great to talk to you, Derek, and good luck with y'all's investigations.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, that is so interesting, and what a lofty goal to visit all those places. I just feel like that's inviting all the scariness in.
Yeah, that was really crazy. I would love to travel all those places too. And I mean, he just did it in New York, but think about all the different places that you could go and kind of do the same thing.
Even the places that we talk about in our stories would be so cool to visit if we had like $1 million and lots of time.
Build a compound.
Jobs.
We prefer to just talk about going to those places and never actually going.
But I did want to revisit one of our real life haunt contributors from earlier this season, Paola Tristan Arruda.
Oh.
She posted the other day that her and some of our other friends at Live 5 that they went on a tour of the Charleston jail and she had an experience there. I was like, oh my gosh, we need to get you back on to tell us about it. But she just kind of like made it seem like it wasn't a big deal. But she said that she felt someone tap on her shoulder while they were in the jail.
Ooh, creepy.
That's a good one.
But remember, she told us that whole story about how like sensitive she and her
whole family
are to paranormal things. So if anyone was going to feel anything there, I would expect it from her.
That's fun and good for her. And thankfully, the times I've done that tour, I haven't had anything too creepy, but it has all the makings for creepiness there. So for sure, I believe it. But thank you everybody for sharing your haunts with us. We love hearing your stories on Facebook and on Messenger, so keep them coming.
Contribute your real haunt. All you have to do is email us at theunrestpodcast@gmail.com. Or you can call us because I'm the only one that knows the number. It's 843-564-2101.
Unrest in peace.